Chapter 13. In Barcelona, during all those last weeks I spent there, there was a peculiar evil feeling in the air, an atmosphere of suspicion, fear, uncertainty, and veiled hatred. The May fighting had left ineradicable after-effects behind it. With the fall of the Caballero government, the communists had come definitely into power. Internal order had been handed over to communist ministers, and no one doubted that they would smash their political rivals as soon as they got a quarter of a chance. Nothing was happening as yet. I myself had not even any mental picture of what was going to happen. And yet there was a perpetual vague sense of danger, a consciousness of some evil thing that was impending. However little you were actually conspiring, the atmosphere forced you to feel like a conspirator. You seemed to spend all your time holding whispered conversations in corners of cafes and wondering whether that person at the next table was a police spy. Sinister rumours of all kinds were flying round thanks to the press censorship. One was that the Negrín Prieto government was planning to compromise the war. At the time, I was inclined to believe this, for the fascists were closing in on Bilbao, and the government was visibly doing nothing to save it. Basque flags were displayed all over the town, girls rattled collecting boxes in the cafes, and there were the usual broadcasts about heroic defenders. But the Basques were getting no real assistance. It was tempting to believe that the government was playing a double game. Later events have proved that I was quite wrong here, but it seems probable that Bilbao could have been saved if a little more energy had been shown. An offensive on the Aragon front, even an unsuccessful one, would have forced Franco to divert part of his army. As it was, the government did not begin any offensive action till it was far too late. Indeed, till about the time when Bilbao fell. The CNT was distributing in huge numbers a leaflet saying, "Be on your guard," and hinting that a certain party, meaning the communists, was plotting a coup d'etat. There was also a widespread fear that Catalonia was going to be invaded. Earlier, when we went back to the front, I had seen the powerful defences that were being constructed scores of miles behind the front line, and fresh bomb-proof shelters were being dug all over Barcelona. There were frequent scares of air raids and sea raids. More often than not, these were false alarms. But every time the sirens blew, the lights all over the town blacked out for hours on end, and timid people dived for the cellars. Police spies were everywhere. The jails were still crammed with prisoners left over from the May fighting, and others, always, of course, anarchist and Puma adherents, were disappearing into jail by ones and twos. So far as one could discover, no one was ever tried or even charged. Not even charged with anything so definite as Trotskyism. You were simply flung into jail and kept there, usually incommunicado. Bob Smilly was still in jail in Valencia. We could discover nothing except that neither the ILP representative on the spot nor the lawyer who had been engaged was permitted to see him. Foreigners from the International Column and other militias were getting into jail in larger and larger numbers. Usually they were arrested as deserters. It was typical of the general situation that nobody now knew for certain whether a militiaman was a volunteer or a regular soldier. A few months earlier, anyone enlisting in the militia had been told that he was a volunteer and could, if he wished, get his discharge papers at any time when he was due for leave. Now it appeared that the government had changed its mind. A militiaman was a regular soldier and counted as a deserter if he tried to go home. But even about this, no one seemed certain. At some parts of the front, the authorities were still issuing discharges. At the frontier, these were sometimes recognised, sometimes not. If not, you were promptly thrown into jail. Later, the number of foreign deserters in jail swelled into hundreds, but most of them were repatriated when a fuss was made in their own countries. Bands of armed assault guards roamed everywhere in the streets. The civil guards were still holding cafes and other buildings in strategic spots, and many of the PSUC buildings were still sandbagged and barricaded. At various points in the town, there were posts manned by civil guards or carabineros who stopped passers-by and demanded their papers. Everyone warned me not to show my Poom militiaman's card, but merely to show my passport and my hospital ticket. Even to be known to have served in the Poom militia was vaguely dangerous. Poom militiamen who were wounded or on leave were penalised in petty ways. It was made difficult for them to draw their pay, for instance. La Bataille was still appearing, but it was censored almost out of existence, and Solidaridad and the other anarchist papers were also heavily censored. There was a new rule that censored portions of a newspaper must not be left blank, but filled up with other matter. As a result, it was often impossible to tell when something had been cut out. The food shortage, which had fluctuated throughout the war, was in one of its bad stages. Bread was scarce, and the cheaper sorts were being adulterated with rice. The bread the soldiers were getting in the barracks was dreadful stuff, like putty. Milk and sugar were very scarce, and tobacco was almost non-existent, except for the expensive smuggled cigarettes. There was an acute shortage of olive oil, which Spaniards used for half a dozen different purposes. The queues of women waiting to buy olive oil were controlled by mounted civil guards, who sometimes amused themselves by backing their horses into the queue and trying to make them tread on the women's toes. A minor annoyance at the time was the lack of small change. The silver had been withdrawn, and as yet no new coinage had been issued, so that there was nothing between the 10 centime piece and the note for 2.5 pesetas. And all notes below 10 pesetas were very scarce. The purchasing value of the peseta was about 4p. For the poorest people, this meant an aggravation of the food shortage. A woman with only a 10 peseta note in her possession might wait for hours in a queue outside the grocery, and then be unable to buy anything after all because the grocer had no change and she could not afford to spend the whole note. It's not easy to convey the nightmare atmosphere of that time, the peculiar uneasiness produced by rumours that were always changing, by censored newspapers, and the constant presence of armed men. It's not easy to convey it because, at the moment, the thing essential to such an atmosphere doesn't exist in England. In England, political intolerance is not yet taken for granted. There's political persecution in a petty way. If I were a coal miner, I wouldn't care to be known to the boss as a communist. But the good party man, the gangster gramophone of continental politics, is still a rarity, and the notion of liquidating or eliminating everyone who happens to disagree with you does not yet seem natural. It seemed only too natural in Barcelona. The Stalinists were in the saddle, and therefore it was a matter of course that every Trotskyist was in danger. The thing everyone feared was a thing which, after all, did not happen, a fresh outbreak of street fighting, which, as before, would be blamed on the Poom and the anarchists. There were times when I caught my ears listening for the first shots. It was as though some huge evil intelligence were brooding over the town. Everyone noticed it and remarked upon it, and it was queer how everyone expressed it in almost the same words. The atmosphere of this place is horrible, like being in a lunatic asylum. But perhaps I ought not to say everyone. Some of the English visitors who flitted briefly through Spain from hotel to hotel seemed not to have noticed that there was anything wrong with the general atmosphere. The Duchess of Athol writes, I notice, in the Sunday Express, the 17th of October, 1937, I was in Valencia, Madrid, and Barcelona. Perfect order prevailed in all three towns without any display of force. All the hotels in which I stayed were not only normal and decent, but extremely comfortable, in spite of the shortage of butter and coffee. It is a peculiarity of English travellers that they don't really believe in the existence of anything outside the smart hotels. I hope they found some butter for the Duchess. I was at the Sanatorium Morin, one of the sanatoria run by the Poom. It was in the suburbs near Tibidabo, the queer-shaped mountain that rises abruptly behind Barcelona, and is traditionally supposed to have been the hill from which Satan showed Jesus the countries of the earth, hence its name. The house had previously belonged to some wealthy bourgeois and had been seized at the time of the revolution. Most of the men there had either been invalided out of the line or had some wound that had permanently disabled them, amputated limbs and so forth. There were several other Englishmen there, Williams, with a damaged leg, and Stafford Cotman, a boy of 18 who had been sent back from the trenches with suspected tuberculosis, and Arthur Clinton, whose smashed left arm was still strapped onto one of those huge wire contraptions nicknamed aeroplanes, which the Spanish hospitals were using. My wife was still staying at the Hotel Continental, and I generally came into Barcelona in the daytime. In the morning I used to attend the General Hospital for electrical treatment of my arm. It was a queer business, a series of prickly electric shocks that made the various sets of muscles jerk up and down. But it seemed to do some good. The use of my fingers came back, and the pain grew somewhat less. Both of us had decided that the best thing we could do was to go back to England as soon as possible. I was extremely weak, my voice was gone, seemingly for good, and the doctors told me that at best it would be several months before I was fit to fight. I had got to start earning some money sooner or later, and there didn't seem much sense in staying in Spain and eating food that was needed for other people. But my motives were mainly selfish. I had an overwhelming desire to get away from it all, away from the horrible atmosphere of political suspicion and hatred, from streets thronged by armed men, from air raids, trenches, machine guns, screaming trams, milkless tea, oil cookery and shortage of cigarettes, from almost everything that I had learnt to associate with Spain. The doctors at the General Hospital had certified me medically unfit, but to get my discharge I had to see a medical board at one of the hospitals near the front, and then go to see Atamo to get my papers stamped at the Poom Militia headquarters. Cop had just come back from the front, full of jubilation. He had just been in action and said that Huesca was going to be taken at last. The government had brought troops from the Madrid front and were concentrating 30,000 men with aeroplanes in huge numbers. The Italians I had seen going up the line from Tarragona had attacked on the Jaca road, but had had heavy casualties and lost two tanks. However, the town was bound to fall, Cop said. Alas, it didn't. The attack was a frightful mess-up and led to nothing except an orgy of lying in the newspapers. Meanwhile, Cop had to go down to Valencia for an interview with the Ministry of War. He had a letter from General Pozas, now commanding the Army of the East, the usual letter describing Cop as a person of all confidence and recommending him for a special appointment in the engineering section. Cop had been an engineer in civil life. He left for Valencia the same day as I left for Ciutat, the 15th of June. It was 5 days before I got back to Barcelona. A lorry load of us reached Ciutat about midnight, and as soon as we got to the Poom headquarters, they lined us up and began handing out rifles and cartridges before even taking our names. It seemed that the attack was beginning, and they were likely to call for reserves at any moment. I had my hospital ticket in my pocket, but I could not very well refuse to go with the others. I kipped down on the ground with a cartridge box for a pillow, in a mood of deep dismay. Being wounded had spoiled my nerve for the time being. I believe this usually happens, and the prospect of being under fire frightened me horribly. However, there was a bit of manana, as usual. We were not called out after all, and next morning I produced my hospital ticket and went in search of my discharge. It meant a series of confused, tiresome journeys. As usual, they bandied one to and fro from hospital to hospital, Ciutat, Barbastro, Monzon, then back to Ciutat to get my discharge stamped, then down the line again via Barbastro and Lérida, and the convergence of troops on Huesca had monopolized all the transport and disorganized everything. I remember sleeping in queer places, once in a hospital bed, but once in a ditch, once on a very narrow bench, which I fell off in the middle of the night, and once in a sort of municipal lodging house in Barbastro. As soon as you got away from the railroad, there was no way of travelling except by jumping chance lorries. You had to wait by the roadside for hours, sometimes 3 or 4 hours at a stretch, with knots of disconsolate peasants who carried bundles full of ducks and rabbits, waving to lorry after lorry. When finally you struck a lorry that was not chock full of men, loaves of bread or ammunition boxes, the bumping over the vile roads walloped you to pulp. No horse has ever thrown me so high as those lorries used to throw me. The only way of travelling was to crowd all together and cling to one another. To my humiliation, I found that I was still too weak to climb onto a lorry without being helped. I slept a night at Monzon Hospital, where I went to see my medical board. In the next bed to me there was an assault guard, wounded over the left eye. He was friendly and gave me cigarettes. I said, in Barcelona we should have been shooting one another, and we laughed over this. It was queer how the general spirit seemed to change when you got anywhere near the front line. All, or nearly all, of the vicious hatreds of the political parties evaporated. During all the time I was at the front, I never once remember any PSUC adherent showing me hostility because I was Poom. That kind of thing belonged in Barcelona, or in places even remoter from the war. There were a lot of assault guards in Ciutamo. They'd been sent on from Barcelona to take part in the attack on Huesca. The assault guards were a corps not intended primarily for the front, and many of them had not been under fire before. Down in Barcelona they were lords of the street, but up here they were quintos, rookies, and piled up with militia children of 15 who had been in the line for months. At Monzon Hospital, the doctor did the usual tongue-pulling and mirror-thrusting business, assured me in the same cheerful manner as the others that I should never have a voice again, and signed my certificate. While I waited to be examined, there was going on inside the surgery some dreadful operation without anaesthetics. Why without anaesthetics, I don't know. It went on and on, scream after scream. And when I went in there, there were chairs flung about, and on the floor were pools of blood and urine. The details of that final journey stand out in my mind with strange clarity. I was in a different mood, a more observing mood than I'd been in for months past. I got my discharge, stamped with the seal of the 29th Division, and the doctor's certificate in which I was declared useless. I was free to go back to England. Consequently, I felt able, almost for the first time, to look at Spain. I had a day to put in at Barbastro, for there was only one train a day. Previously I had seen Barbastro in brief glimpses, and it had seemed to me simply a part of the war, a grey, muddy, cold place, full of roaring lorries and shabby troops. It seemed queerly different now. Wandering through it, I became aware of pleasant, tortuous streets, old stone bridges, wine shops with great oozy barrels as tall as a man, and intriguing semi-subterranean shops where men were making cartwheels, daggers, wooden spoons, and goatskin water bottles. I watched a man making a skin bottle, and discovered with great interest what I had never known before, that they are made with the fur inside, and the fur is not removed, so that you're really drinking distilled goat's hair. I'd drunk out of them for months without knowing this. And at the back of the town there was a shallow jade-green river, and rising out of it a perpendicular cliff of rock with houses built into the rock, so that from your bedroom window you could spit straight into the water 100 feet below. Innumerable doves lived in the holes in the cliff. And in Lérida there were old crumbling buildings upon whose cornices thousands upon thousands of swallows had built their nests, so that at a little distance the crusted pattern of nests was like some florid moulding of the Rococo period. It was queer how for nearly 6 months past I had had no eyes for such things. With my discharge papers in my pocket I felt like a human being again, and also a little like a tourist. For almost the first time I felt that I was really in Spain, in a country that I had longed all my life to visit. In the quiet back streets of Lérida and Barbastro, I seemed to catch a momentary glimpse, a sort of far-off rumour, of the Spain that dwells in everyone's imagination. White sierras, goat herds, dungeons of the Inquisition, Moorish palaces, black winding trains of mules, grey olive trees and groves of lemons, girls in black mantillas, the wines of Malaga and Alicante, cathedrals, cardinals, bullfights, gypsies, serenades. In short, Spain. Of all Europe, it was the country that had had most hold upon my imagination. It seemed a pity that when at last I had managed to come here, I had seen only this northeastern corner in the middle of a confused war, and for the most part in winter. It was late when I got back to Barcelona, and there were no taxis. It was no use trying to get to the Sanatorium Maureen, which was right outside the town, so I made for the Hotel Continental, stopping for dinner on the way. I remember the conversation I had with a very fatherly waiter about the oak jugs bound with copper in which they served the wine. I said I would like to buy a set of them to take back to England. The waiter was sympathetic. Yes, beautiful were they not, but impossible to buy nowadays. Nobody was manufacturing them any longer. Nobody was manufacturing anything. This war, such a pity. We agreed that the war was a pity. Once again, I felt like a tourist. The waiter asked me gently, had I liked Spain? Would I come back to Spain? Oh, yes, I should come back to Spain. The peaceful quality of this conversation sticks in my memory because of what happened immediately afterwards. When I got to the hotel, my wife was sitting in the lounge. She got up and came towards me in what struck me as a very unconcerned manner. Then she put an arm round my neck and, with a sweet smile for the benefit of the other people in the lounge, hissed in my ear, "Get out!" "What?" "Get out of here at once!" "What?" "Don't keep standing here. You must get outside quickly." "Why? What? What do you mean?" She had me by the arm and was already leading me towards the stairs. Halfway down we met a Frenchman. I'm not going to give his name, for though he had no connection with the Poom, he was a good friend to us all during the trouble. He looked at me with a concerned face. "Listen, you mustn't come in here. Get out quickly and hide yourself before they ring up the police." And behold, at the bottom of the stairs, one of the hotel staff, who was a Poom member, unknown to the management, I fancy, slipped furtively out of the lift and told me in broken English to get out. Even now I didn't grasp what had happened. "What the devil is all this about?" I said, as soon as we were on the pavement. "Haven't you heard?" "No, heard what? I've heard nothing. The Poom's been suppressed. They've seized all the buildings. Practically everyone's in prison, and they say they're shooting people already." So that was it. We had to have somewhere to talk. All the big cafes on the Ramblas were thronged with police, but we found a quiet cafe in a side street. My wife explained to me what had happened while I was away. On the 15th of June, the police had suddenly arrested Andres Nin in his office, and the same evening had raided the Hotel Falcon and arrested all the people in it, mostly militiamen on leave. The place was converted immediately into a prison, and in a very little while it was filled to the brim with prisoners of all kinds. Next day, the Poom was declared an illegal organization, and all its offices, bookstores, sanatoria, Red Aid centres and so forth were seized. Meanwhile, the police were arresting everyone they could lay hands on who was known to have any connection with the Poom. Within a day or two, all, or almost all, of the 40 members of the executive committee were in prison. Possibly one or two had escaped into hiding, but the police were adopting the trick, extensively used on both sides in this war, of seizing a man's wife as a hostage if he disappeared. There was no way of discovering how many people had been arrested. My wife had heard that it was about 400 in Barcelona alone. I've since thought that even at that time the number must have been greater. And the most fantastic people had been arrested. In some cases, the police had even gone to the length of dragging wounded militiamen out of the hospitals. It was all profoundly dismaying. What the devil was it all about? I could understand their suppressing the Poom. But what were they arresting people for? For nothing, so far as one could discover. Apparently, the suppression of the Poom had a retrospective effect. The Poom was now illegal, and therefore one was breaking the law by having previously belonged to it. As usual, none of the arrested people had been charged. Meanwhile, however, the Valencia communist papers were flaming with the story of a huge fascist plot, radio communication with the enemy, documents signed in invisible ink, etc., etc. I've dealt with this story earlier. The significant thing was that it was appearing only in the Valencia papers. I think I'm right in saying that there was not a single word about it or about the suppression of the Poom in any Barcelona papers, communist, anarchist or Republican. We first learned the precise nature of the charges against the Poom leaders, not from any Spanish paper, but from the English papers that reached Barcelona a day or two later. What we could not know at this time was that the government was not responsible for the charge of treachery and espionage, and that members of the government were later to repudiate it. We only vaguely knew that the Poom leaders, and presumably all the rest of us, were accused of being in fascist pay. and already the rumours were flying round that people were being secretly shot in jail. There was a lot of exaggeration about this, but it certainly happened in some cases, and there is not much doubt that it happened in the case of Nin. After his arrest, Nin was transferred to Valencia and thence to Madrid, and as early as the 21st of June the rumour reached Barcelona that he had been shot. Later the rumour took a more definite shape. Nin had been shot in prison by the secret police and his body dumped into the street. This story came from several sources, including Federico Montsenis, an ex-member of the government. From that day to this, Nin has never been heard of alive again. When, later, the government were questioned by delegates from various countries, they shilly-shallied and would say only that Nin had disappeared and they knew nothing of his whereabouts. Some of the newspapers produced a tale that he had escaped fascist territory. No evidence was given in support of it, and Irujo, the Minister of Justice, later declared that the Espan news agency had falsified his official communique. In any case, it's most unlikely that a political prisoner of Nin's importance would be allowed to escape, unless at some future time he is produced alive. I think we must take it that he was murdered in prison. The tale of arrests went on and on, extending over months, until the number of political prisoners, not counting fascists, swelled into thousands. One noticeable thing was the autonomy of the lower ranks of the police. Many of the arrests were admittedly illegal, and various people whose release had been ordered by the chief of police were rearrested at the jail gate and carried off to secret prisons. A typical case is that of Kurt Landau and his wife. They were arrested about the 17th of June, and Landau immediately disappeared. 5 months later, his wife was still in jail, untried and without news of her husband. She declared a hunger strike, after which the Minister of Justice sent word to assure her that her husband was dead. Shortly afterwards, she was released, to be almost immediately rearrested and flung into prison again, and it was noticeable that the police, at any rate at first, seemed completely indifferent as to any effect their actions might have upon the war. They were quite ready to arrest military officers at important posts without getting permission beforehand. About the end of June, José Rovira, the general commanding the 29th Division, was arrested somewhere near the front line by a party of police who had been sent from Barcelona. His men sent a delegation to protest at the Ministry of War. It was found that neither the Ministry of War nor Ortega, the chief of police, had even been informed of Rovira's arrest. In the whole business, the detail that most sticks in my throat, though perhaps it's not of great importance, is that all news of what was happening was kept from the troops at the front. As you will have seen, neither I nor anyone else at the front had heard anything about the suppression of the PUM. All the PUM militia headquarters, Red Aid centres and so forth were functioning as usual. And as late as the 20th of June, and as far down the line as Lérida, only about 100 miles from Barcelona, no one had heard what was happening. All word of it was kept out of the Barcelona papers. The Valencia papers, which were running the spy stories, did not reach the Aragon front. And no doubt one reason for arresting all the PUM militiamen on leave in Barcelona was to prevent them from getting back to the front with the news. The draft with which I had gone up the line on the 15th of June must have been about the last to go. I'm still puzzled to know how the thing was kept secret, for the supply lorries and so forth were still passing to and fro, but there is no doubt that it was kept secret. And as I've since learned from a number of others, the men in the front line heard nothing till several days later. The motive for all this was clear enough. The attack on Huesca was beginning, the PUM militia was still a separate unit, and it was probably feared that if the men knew what was happening, they would refuse to fight. Actually, nothing of the kind happened when the news arrived. In the intervening days, there must have been numbers of men who were killed without ever learning that the newspapers in the rear were calling them fascists. This kind of thing is a little difficult to forgive. I know it was the usual policy to keep bad news from the troops, and perhaps, as a rule, that is justified, but it's a different matter to send men into battle and not even tell them that behind their backs their party is being suppressed, their leaders accused of treachery, and their friends and relatives thrown into prison. My wife began telling me what had happened to our various friends. Some of the English and other foreigners had got across the frontier. Williams and Stafford Cotman had not been arrested when the sanatorium Morin was raided and were in hiding somewhere. So was John McNair, who had been in France and had re-entered Spain after the Poom was declared illegal. A rash thing to do, but he'd not cared to stay in safety while his comrades were in danger. For the rest, it was simply a chronicle of they've got so-and-so, and they've got so-and-so. They seemed to have got nearly everyone. It took me aback to hear they had also got George Kopp. What? Kopp? I thought he was in Valencia. It appeared that Kopp had come back to Barcelona. He had a letter from the Ministry of War to the colonel commanding the engineering operations on the Eastern Front. He knew that the Poom had been suppressed, of course, but probably it didn't occur to him that the police could be such fools as to arrest him when he was on his way to the front on an urgent military mission. He had come round to the Hotel Continental to fetch his kit bags. My wife had been out at the time, and the hotel people had managed to detain him with some lying story while they rang up the police. I admit I was angry when I heard of Kopp's arrest. He was my personal friend. I had served under him for months. I had been under fire with him, and I knew his history. He was a man who had sacrificed everything. Family, nationality, livelihood, simply to come to Spain and fight against fascism. By leaving Belgium without permission and joining a foreign army while he was on the Belgian Army Reserve, and earlier, by helping to manufacture munitions illegally for the Spanish government, he had piled up years of imprisonment for himself if he should ever return to his own country. He had been in the line since October 1936, had worked his way up from militiaman to major, had been in action I don't know how many times, and had been wounded once. During the May trouble, as I had seen for myself, he had prevented fighting locally and probably saved 10 or 20 lives, and all they could do in return was to fling him into jail. It's a waste of time to be angry, but the stupid malignity of this kind of thing does try one's patience. Meanwhile, they had not got my wife. Although she had remained at the Continental, the police had made no move to arrest her. It was fairly obvious that she was being used as a decoy duck. A couple of nights earlier, however, in the small hours of the morning, six of the plainclothes police had invaded our room at the hotel and searched it. They'd seized every scrap of paper we possessed, except, fortunately, our passports and checkbooks. They'd taken my diaries, all our books, all the press cuttings that had been piling up for months past. I've often wondered what use those press cuttings were to them. All my war souvenirs and all our letters. Incidentally, they took away a number of letters I'd received from readers. Some of them had not been answered, and of course I've not the addresses. If anyone who wrote to me about my last book and who didn't get an answer happens to read these lines, will you please accept this as an apology? I learned afterwards that the police had also seized various belongings that I had left at the Sanatorium Morin. They even carried off a bundle of my dirty linen. Perhaps they thought it had messages written on it in invisible ink. It was obvious that it would be safer for my wife to stay at the hotel, at any rate for the time being. If she tried to disappear, they would be after her immediately. As for myself, I should have to go straight into hiding. The prospect revolted me. In spite of the innumerable arrests, it was almost impossible for me to believe that I was in any danger. The whole thing seemed too meaningless. It was the same refusal to take this idiotic onslaught seriously that had led Kopp into jail. I kept saying, but why should anyone want to arrest me? What had I done? I wasn't even a member of the Poom. Certainly I carried arms during the May fighting, but so had, I guess, 40 or 50,000 people. Besides, I was badly in need of a proper night's sleep. I wanted to risk it and go back to the hotel. My wife would not hear of it. Patiently, she explained the state of affairs. It did not matter what I had done or not done. This was not a roundup of criminals. It was merely a reign of terror. I was not guilty of any definite act, but I was guilty of Trotskyism. The fact that I had served in the Poom militia was enough to get me into prison. It was no use hanging on to the English notion that you are safe so long as you keep the law. Practically, the law was what the police chose to make it. The only thing to do was to lie low and conceal the fact that I had anything to do with the poom. We went through the papers in my pockets. My wife made me tear up my militiaman's card, which had P-O-U-M on it in big letters. Also, a photo of a group of militiamen with a poom flag in the background. That was the kind of thing that got you arrested nowadays. I had to keep my discharge papers, however. Even these were a danger, for they bore the seal of the 29th Division, and the police would probably know that the 29th Division was the poom. But without them, I could be arrested as a deserter. The thing we had got to think of now was getting out of Spain. There was no sense in staying here, with the certainty of imprisonment sooner or later. As a matter of fact, both of us would greatly have liked to stay just to see what happened. But I foresaw that Spanish prisons would be lousy places. Actually, they were a lot worse than I'd imagined. Once in prison, you never knew when you'd get out. And I was in wretched health, apart from the pain in my arm. We arranged to meet next day at the British Consulate, where Cotman and McNair were also coming. It would probably take a couple of days to get our passports in order. Before leaving Spain, you had to have your passport stamped in three separate places, by the chief of police, by the French consul, and by the Catalan immigration authorities. The chief of police was the danger, of course. But perhaps the British consul could fix things up without letting it be known that we had anything to do with the poom. Obviously, there must be a list of foreign Trotskyist suspects, and very likely our names were on it. But with luck, we might get to the frontier before the list. There was sure to be a lot of muddle and manana. Fortunately, this was Spain and not Germany. The Spanish secret police had some of the spirit of the Gestapo, but not much of its competence. So we parted. My wife went back to the hotel, and I wandered off into the darkness to find somewhere to sleep. I remember feeling sulky and bored. I had so wanted a night in bed. There was nowhere I could go, no house where I could take refuge. The poom had practically no underground organization. No doubt the leaders had always realized that the party was likely to be suppressed, but they had never expected a wholesale witch hunt of this description. They'd expected it so little, indeed, that they were actually continuing the alterations to the poom buildings. Among other things, they were constructing a cinema in the executive building, which had previously been a bank, up to the very day when the poom was suppressed. Consequently, the rendezvous and hiding places which every revolutionary party ought to possess as a matter of course did not exist. Goodness knows how many people whose homes had been raided by the police, were sleeping in the streets that night. I had had 5 days of tiresome journeys, sleeping in impossible places. My arm was hurting damnably, and now these fools were chasing me to and fro, and I got to sleep on the ground again. That was about as far as my thoughts went. I didn't make any of the correct political reflections. I never do when things are happening. It seems to be always the case when I get mixed up in war or politics. I am conscious of nothing save physical discomfort and a deep desire for this damn nonsense to be over. Afterwards, I can see the significance of events, but while they're happening, I merely want to be out of them. An ignoble trait, perhaps. I walked a long way and fetched up somewhere near the General Hospital. I wanted a place where I could lie down without some nosing policeman finding me and demanding my papers. I tried an air raid shelter, but it was newly dug and dripping with damp. Then I came upon the ruins of a church that had been gutted and burnt in the Revolution. It was a mere shell, 4 roofless walls surrounding piles of rubble. In the half-darkness I poked about and found a kind of hollow where I could lie down. Lumps of broken masonry are not good to lie on, but fortunately it was a warm night, and I managed to get several hours' sleep. Chapter 14. The worst of being wanted by the police in a town like Barcelona is that everything opens so late. When you sleep out of doors, you always wake about dawn, and none of the Barcelona cafes open much before 9. It was hours before I could get a cup of coffee or a shave. It seemed queer in the barber's shop to see the anarchist notice still on the wall explaining that tips were prohibited. "The revolution has struck off our chains," the notice said. I felt like telling the barbers that their chains would soon be back again if they didn't look out. I wandered back to the centre of the town. Over the Poom buildings, the red flags had been torn down, Republican flags were floating in their place, and knots of armed civil guards were lounging in the doorways. At the Red Aid Centre, on the corner of the Plaza de Catalunya, the police had amused themselves by smashing most of the windows. The Poom bookstores had been emptied of books, and the notice board farther down the Ramblas had been plastered with an anti-Poom cartoon, the one representing the mask and the fascist face beneath. Down at the bottom of the Ramblas, near the quay, I came upon a queer sight. A row of militiamen, still ragged and muddy from the front, sprawling exhaustedly on the chairs placed there for the bootblacks. I knew who they were. Indeed, I recognised one of them. They were Poom militiamen who had come down the line on the previous day to find that the Poom had been suppressed and had had to spend the night in the streets because their homes had been raided. Any Poom militiaman who returned to Barcelona at this time had the choice of going straight into hiding or into jail. Not a pleasant reception after 3 or 4 months in the line